Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Grace Wan. As protests in response to George Floyd's death continue, former Presidents Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama have issued statements decrying Floyd's death and calling for unity. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has advocated an authoritarian military response to protests and staged a widely criticized photo op in front of St. John's Episcopal Church. Trump's volatile leadership has intensified calls to vote him out. President Obama's former campaign manager, David Plouffe, has a game plan for how that can be done. And later this hour, we'll talk to him about his new book, A Citizen's Guide to Beating Donald Trump. And at the end of the hour, we'll chat with award-winning jazz guitarist and educator Terrence Brewer about how musicians like him are responding to the combination of pandemic and protests. But first, this afternoon, a peaceful and student-led demonstration took place at Dolores Park, marking the ninth day of marches and demonstrations here in the Bay Area. Reflecting on the outpouring of grief and frustration, our guest, San Francisco Chronicle columnist Otis Taylor, wrote on Monday, "If you lack perspective on why people are in the streets, ask yourself this. If Black people weren't fatally shot by police at a disproportionate rate, would we be shouting, 'Hands up, don't shoot,' and 'I can't breathe,' as they march through the cities?" To talk about what we're witnessing, I'm pleased to be joined by Otis Taylor tonight. Welcome, Otis.
Hey, Grace. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm worn out, frankly. Just getting back so I could chat with you. I was at another protest. It seems like a daily occurrence. But at the same time, though, Grace, I'm also energized that we're finally approaching having the conversation that this country has denied and ignored for so long. So that's what's giving me energy and keeping me going, even though I'm not sleeping well, I'm not eating well. I mean, I'm having Fruit Loops for dinner. It's just,
yes.
But, you know, I'm energized because, you know, leaving Oakland where people are actively defying the curfew, but they're doing it so peacefully. And they were sitting down on Broadway in downtown Oakland. It was such a beautiful scene because it seemed like people were happy in the midst of all this despair and destruction that we're surrounded by. And by destruction, I don't mean the looting. I mean what our federal government has done to this country.
Well, in your column on Monday, you said that these demonstrations are something different. And I was struck by the fact that President Obama in his remarks said that the protests were something that he'd never seen in his lifetime himself. Tell us a little bit about what you think is different.
So, you know, I first had that thought. It was Friday night, just after dark. And how people were showing up, it wasn't a group or an organization calling for people to show up or sending out a press release or an email. It seemed like a very decentralized organizing that was going on. And then being out on the street, I feel that they're not getting tired. They're not dismayed by the tear gas. They're not dismayed by the rubber bullets. Speaking of rubber bullets, the targeting of journalists that we're seeing going on across the country. I know Friday night that I'm, you know, got my badge. Of course it was dark. I have a notebook in my hand and I'm, you know, talking to someone and this guy, they were standing in front of me. I'm talking here and this guy to my right goes, and then people start scattering. He got hit with a rubber bullet. And it's like, we are nowhere near we were the line, but we were nowhere near the officers. We're just standing there.
And is this in Oakland?
Yes.
San Francisco?
This was in Oakland. And the young man got shot. But then he took the it's a blue rubber bullet as a souvenir. So that's that.
But, okay.
Saturday night, I was in Oakland. And as you know, many businesses had their glass broken and some businesses were looted. Well, I spent Saturday night with Black business owners and I wanted to get a sense of how they were coping because, as you know, we're going to enter recession and Black and brown communities are going to be disproportionately impacted by that recession. It happened 12 years ago. It's going to happen again. But what different this time, Black businesses were not expressing anger about what happened. We stand with the people. Because they know what this moment means. This is a moment with all these protests going on in what, more than 150 cities in this country, and they're cascading across the world, I think people realize that this is an opportunity that we haven't had before, where this country, it should, I hope it does, have a reckoning with race.
Yeah, and it seems one of the differences is that instead of just happening in African-American, predominantly African-American communities, the protests, the demonstrations are happening across cities and at different neighborhoods, and the people who are showing up aren't just people of color.
No, not at all. Monday was one of the most thrilling experiences that I've had covering a protest. It wasn't even about, you know, oh, people are breaking glass or, oh, people running over here. It was two young black college students on Instagram organized this rally outside of Oakland Technical High School. And by the time I got down there, I mean, I think the actual count was somewhere around 15,000. Broadway just bulged with people. And here's the thing that I want to say, that I've having conversations with a lot of people right now, readers, friends, neighbors, about race. And I met up actually with a young white girl. She's a rising senior at Oakland Tech High School. And I had met her in 2018 when students walked out to protest gun violence. And then we were connected in 2019 when students walked out to protest education cuts. And this time she's there with two of her friends, but she's also there with her mother. Mm-hmm. That's different. And her mother is like, my daughter's been talking to me, you know, I need to support this. And her two friends, their mother was out. And so it was like a family vibe. And, you know, I'm walking with this high school student, her mother and her two friends and their mother. And it's like, okay, you know, small sample, but maybe we're getting someplace with this. But of course it ends with, and I don't say violence by the protesters, because I think what some police departments are doing in the Bay Area, and they're also doing across the country, is violent. I mean, if I'm just walking down the street and talking to you, I don't think you have cause to put your hands on my body. And that's exactly what is happening to black and brown bodies across this country.
Well, I think you've written that there was a quote in your column that really struck me. It's the fragility of blackness hangs over my head every time I leave the house. Yeah. And it seems like the world got a window into that fragility with the filmed murders of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery. And certainly it shouldn't take a video to validate that experience. But can you talk a little bit more about that fragility and how the capturing on film may have really solidified what that feels like for people?
Yeah. And that's the thing. It, you know, I've only watched that video one time, because one time was enough. It took me back to that place, Eric Garner's death, specifically saying he can't breathe. But it also took me back to that place where Philando Castile was shot again. Just watching a man's life expire in front of you at the hands of the people who are charged to protect and serve us. This, it just makes me know, and I want other people to know, that as a person with brown skin in this country, it does not matter what your station is in life. If you engage with a police officer who wants to take possession of your body and your life, they can. I'm sure people have seen the videos circulating on the internet where recently an FBI agent was handcuffed by two white police officers because he was sitting on a table and they, you know, wanted to mess with him. And that you just see their faces when they finally look in his wallet, ask him who he is, and they see he's an FBI agent, and it looks so dumb. I would like to say also that right now we're talking about the vulnerability of black and brown bodies. A young man in Vallejo was shot and killed early Tuesday morning. He allegedly, and I want to say that again, he allegedly was looting a Walgreens. When police came upon him, he was just walking beside the building. He said when they approached him, he got down on his knee. They said what he had in his pocket looked like a gun. So this officer opened fire at him through the window of the police cruiser. How is that protocol? How is it shoot first, ask questions later? Even if he was looting, you legally cannot shoot somebody for taking personal property. And this man was killed. And what really gets me is that this police department has a history of violence. And we are in this pivotal moment in our country's history, and police officers in that department still cannot control themselves. They cannot control their penchant for violence. That is problematic. And then, you know, city officials want to say, it's a slap in the face to residents who I've been reporting on. At a press conference Tuesday, which when they didn't even acknowledge that the young man had died, they said, actually, the mayor said that, I hear you. I hear your voices. And that really angered some people in the community because we've been telling you about police brutality for years. So some man has to die in Minnesota for you to hear us in your hometown or in your city. Vallejo is really bad right now, like a lot of cities in our country.
I think we're hearing and getting arguments back. People say, oh, it's just one bad apple. It's not the entire police department.
Oh, gosh.
But I think what we're seeing right now is that the problems are systemic.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I have, I wrote a column on Vallejo that should be published in the morning. And I pointed out that since 2010, there have been more than 40 officer-involved shootings in that department. 14 officers in that department have been in multiple shootings. How is that possible? So to your point, Grace, what you're saying, when people, and I'll say white people, they're socialized. I wrote a column that to fear blackness, but they're also socialized to believe that racism is just, it's an individual problem. It's not a systemic issue. And I hear that a lot about policing. Well, you know, all the police departments aren't bad, but you know, the Obama administration put a lot of police departments in this country under consent decree. One of the first things Jeff Sessions did as attorney general was revoke those.
So, tell our listeners what that is, a consent decree.
Okay. Yeah. So the Justice Department in effect, I don't want to say control, but these police departments had to report to the Justice Department, who had the ability to go in there and say, that's not good enough, or you need to fix this. What Jeff Sessions did was saying, hey, we don't need any oversight of our police department because one of the issues, there's no systemic racism in our police departments. Here's the thing that I hope the George Floyd video shows people is that, so if you want to say, okay, well, the officer that had his knee on that man's neck for 8 minutes is a racist. Okay. But he also had power over the other officers who didn't stop him, who didn't say, hey man, he's saying he can't breathe. Maybe you should back off. You know why? Because in police departments, when an officer contradicts another officer in the field, he gets a talking to. That's what I've heard from my sources in police departments, that it's so hard to correct what you see as wrong because just like in the street, you're seen as a snitch. You're seen as someone who's going against the grain. And I feel that policing won't be reformed until whistleblowers have some kind of protection to say, hey, man, that's not right. That was a bad arrest, or you didn't have to throw that guy down. One thing that I've learned about police departments is that so much of our focus is on shooting, and rightfully so. But the unusual or unnecessary use of force, like we saw with George Floyd, that is what is really impacting communities of color right now.
Right. And going back to your statements about what it is like to navigate this world with the fragility, there's been so many testimonials, and this is not new, but the media has focused on the conversations that African-American parents have had with their children mm-hmm. about what it means to be a black or brown body. And I wondered, in your own family, what kind of conversations you've had, and if you could share those out.
Yeah, that's a wow. So, you know, just thinking, like, how do I say? This time is a time of reflection, I think, for everyone. But for me, it's about things I've learned, people I've interacted with. And I want to, before I tell you what I spoke about with my parents, I want to tell you, you know, a little bit about my history. I was born in New Jersey and I spent the first 12 years of my life there. Neither of my parents went to college. And so for their children, they only wanted their children to go to college just so they could choose what they wanted to do. I don't know if my parents are happy with my choice to be a journalist, but
they should be proud. They should, you've done quite well, Otis.
Yeah, salute to them. So I went to, I was on the black kid bus and we got bused to this private school that was about a half an hour. And literally when I say the black kid bus, it was from kindergarten to high school, all the black kids on one bus from City Paterson, New Jersey. And so that's where I started hanging out, making white friends. And one of my closest friends in New Jersey, which interesting enough, we lost contact for 25 years and we reconnected out here in the Bay Area. He lives in San Francisco and we're back together close. But anyway, I was hanging out at his house in an all white, you know, community. And I spent like two nights. And then Sunday he was like, oh, we're going to go to church. And I was, I kind of had a moment because I knew I would be the only black face in that space. And, he really didn't understand what problem I had, but he took it to his mother anyway. And I remember his mom, I went into her room and she's like, you don't want to go? And it's like, yeah, you know, I don't, you know, I just feel uncomfortable. You know, this is like 11-year-old me. And she's like, well, that's okay. We're going to go and we'll be with you. You know, you will be with us. And that's what I'm seeing in the street right now. It's, I am with you. I am standing with you. You're okay because I'm providing myself or my body next to yours to make sure you're okay. That really spoke volumes to me. My parents, I mean, at a very, very early age when they realized they were giving me access to privilege or access to opportunities that they didn't have, they made sure that I understood that I was different. You know, no matter how I was able to move in those circles, I would always be black when it came down to it. And you know what? I had to learn that lesson. I went to a lot of white schools and you know what? People would be nice, but then you'd be watching a basketball game or a football game and someone would say, oh, they're playing N-word ball or something like that. Just, it would just slip out. And then be like, the room would get quiet and they look at me and it's like, well, you guys should deal with this. You know, why do I have to talk to you about this? But right now my mother is so afraid, for me. And my brother, he's a television anchor, in Columbia, South Carolina, where I moved from. She is so afraid of me being out because it only takes one. It only takes one police officer to say, black man, what are you doing? I don't like what you're doing. Oh, you're giving me lip. Even though you're just saying journalist or I give up. I'm not doing anything. All it takes is one officer to put his knee on your neck and you can die.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think one, as you pointed out, the idea of I'll stand with you makes it this movement at this moment a little bit different and meaningful. And so my last question to you, because I know you have another appearance, is how do we keep the momentum alive? You know, we've seen lots of protests, lots of demonstrations. Mm-hmm. I grew up in LA. I was there for the Rodney King riots. Oh, what do we need to do to keep the momentum?
I think, again, it is talking to our friends who are not people of color and making sure that they are having the conversations with their friends, their families, their communities. I spoke to a man today and he was like, you know, I'm going to the police department. I'm handing them a letter. And I was like, that's great. But could you please talk to your neighbors? Could you please talk to your children? Could you please talk to your coworkers? this is not going to be solved with these actions, but I think more and more people, because of this, are willing to acknowledge it exists and then having a conversation about it.
Well, thank you for joining us, Otis Taylor. Otis Taylor is a San Francisco Chronicle columnist specializing in the East Bay. And tomorrow or the next day, he'll have a column about Vallejo, which you should take a look at. And we're so pleased and grateful that you were here with us tonight.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Hi, Grace.
In 2008, our guest, David Plouffe, rewrote the handbook on how to win elections as campaign manager of Barack Obama's campaign. Now, as the country stands on the brink of a pivotal and historic election, which takes place against the backdrop of a pandemic and protests for racial justice, David Plouffe offers us a citizen's guide to beating Donald Trump. That's the name of his new book. Thanks for joining us, David Plouffe.
Hey, Grace.
How are you?
Real pleasure to see you. Yes.
Well, and we want to hear from you, our listeners. It's a real treat to hear from David. So give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email to cityvisions@kalw.org. Or find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. So David, we're 22 weeks away from a presidential election. And between the candidates, I think it's fair to say we're seeing a stark study in contrasts. Vice President Biden spoke yesterday about not governing from fear. Donald Trump has called for a military response and waved a Bible in front of St. John Episcopal Church. After all that we've seen with Donald Trump and his handling of the protests, the pandemic, the state of the economy, is Donald Trump a viable candidate for re-election?
Sadly, he is. I think pre-COVID and pre, the incident in Minneapolis with George Floyd, you'd say the economy is relatively healthy, although lots of people are struggling. Statistically, incumbents, don't lose whether they're running for governor or president with an economy like that. So why was he vulnerable? Well, because people were tired of the racism and the misogyny and the tweets and the narcissism. So that was when things were good. Now we are in, if we're lucky, we're going to stave off a Great Depression, but we're going to be close to that. We obviously have a great unrest around the country that Trump is fomenting and instigating and not leading. So why could he win? So if he was already vulnerable before, well, because this is about the Electoral College. And, right now, I think Michigan of the battleground states is the one I certainly feel like it's going to take a lot of work, but is the most likely to flip back. So let's say you add Pennsylvania to that, which is going to be harder than Michigan. That still leaves Biden short of the presidency. And right now, I'm not comfortable saying Wisconsin, Arizona, Florida, or North Carolina, the next four, none of those are in the bag. So even though there's polling suggesting Biden opening up a lead in some of them, he's not at 50. He's at 48, 44. And so some of that means people have left Trump now. They're saying, you know what, I'm really upset with this guy. But when they have to vote, they may come home. And Trump's going to turn out his base. So as much as people are angry on the other side about Trump, folks in his corner are equally committed to seeing him win. So I think right now it is Joe Biden's race to lose. You'd always rather be in that position. So that is a change. I think 60 days ago, you might give Trump a slight edge, or maybe it's a coin flip. So there has been change there. But, Donald Trump is not going to lose states like Wisconsin or North Carolina or Florida by a big margin. They're going to be close. But I ran presidential campaigns and, we didn't win Florida by a lot. We won a bunch of states narrowly. That's why they're battleground states. But Biden, I think, has more of a trajectory now to being able to win the presidency. But, there has to be as much enthusiasm, I think, for Joe Biden as there is antipathy for Donald Trump. I think the speech Biden gave yesterday was a really important thing to get people a little more fired up about him.
I've been reading your Twitter feed, and I was noticing that, we know that General Mattis has broken with Trump, which is extraordinary. And you were tweeting about the Lincoln Project, which is a group of committed Republicans who are vociferously anti-Trump. And I saw also that a group of Bush alumni have started a super PAC that is anti-Trump. Is it going to help this time around to have Republicans, some Republicans in the corner of Joe Biden?
I think so. No, you go back to 16. I don't know, Grace, if this was your situation, but I certainly, a lot of the Republicans I knew, I had maybe worked against them in politics or had done some business work with them. None of them were voting for Trump, right? And it turns out they were like the only Republicans not voting for Trump. So I'd say two things. You know, if it does become larger, so if Donald Trump were to lose 7, 8, 9% of the Republican vote in battleground states, that's pretty catastrophic for him. But the, you know, people like in the Lincoln Project, Steve Schmidt and Rick Wilson and John Weaver, folks I've, you know, been on the other side of, you know, the battlefield with, you know, I spend time with them now, you know, brainstorming creative ideas, and they're very smart. They're very tough. And the other thing is, you know, they're Republicans, so they come at this a little bit differently. They're, you know, they understand, I think, the language better about how to appeal the center right voters, quite frankly. I think they're doing great work out there. I do think what's interesting on the protests right now, the situation we're in, you know, the business community here in the United States, most citizens, a lot of, you know, police officers, elected officials, you've seen rallies all over the world, massive rallies, by the way, protesting our procedures here. Like the entire world united that we've got a big problem that we need to heal, that we need to focus on solutions. Trump is isolated. So that's the other thing going on here is there are people, you know, who say, even today, I'm glad I voted for him. I wanted to send a message to the system. And, you know, I think he did some things okay, but I'm just tired of it. Okay. Like we can't live through 4 more years of this. And that's the picture the Biden campaign has to paint, which is, do you really want to live through 4 more years of this? Because if he's doing this when he's got to face, you know, the voters essentially to get rehired and he's acting this way, what's he going to be like when there's no constraints? You know, I think the entire enterprise, our democracy, our way of life, our institutions could be shot forever. I know that sounds dramatic, but, you know, this happens in history. No empires, no ways of government last forever. And I think this is, you know, the biggest challenge we've had since 1861.
Well, I think a lot of us are looking for a time when the headlines aren't all in 90-point font. You know,
just right. That would be good.
That would be good. Well, president elections feel so huge and it can be hard to find a way to feel like you're making a difference. And you are a savant when it comes to numbers. It's to encourage people to participate. Can you just highlight how close some of these counties and electoral college votes go that where one or two votes can't actually make a difference?
It does. I mean, so, you know, I look back at, so in our races in the Obama years, you know, we won Florida, massive state, you know, by 75,000 votes the second time, which is literally a vote or two per block. You know, Hillary Clinton narrowly lost Michigan, narrowly lost Wisconsin, narrowly lost Pennsylvania. Obviously, the most jarring example is what happened in Florida, 538 votes. And we have the Iraq War, and we don't fight climate change because George W. Bush wins instead of Al Gore. So that's what people need to think about. If it's close, and we better assume it is, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Florida, if let's say 20,000 people within a state or outside of a state, and there's a great new effort by VoteSaveAmerica.com, which is put on by the Pod Save America crew, where if you live in California, you can sign up to adopt a state. So you say, I want to help in Arizona, and you'll get asked to make phone calls and write postcards if we're allowed to travel there in the fall to do that. But if all of us, so if 20,000 people affected 5 votes in Florida, we win Florida. That's getting people to register, to not vote third party, to turn out. If 5,000 people affect, let's say, two people each, that's it in the state like Michigan, that could be the win number. So it looks big. There's going to be 150 million people vote, but this is a series of state elections, and battleground states by definition are close. And so the average person, and listen, social media has no state lines, sharing content, something you like Biden does, something you don't like Trump does, a funny video, a funny GIF, the Lincoln Project, send that out, create your own content. Volunteer. If you're here in California, it's important to win local races and help local candidates. But a lot of people do want to get involved in a presidential race. So I will help in Arizona, say. I will make phone calls to people we need to register. I will do GOTV calls. I will write postcards. I will do social media. If I can go down there, I will. That's where the action is. And so when you think about your effort in the individual, it can seem like, what does that matter? But if you think about it in the aggregate, it's so powerful. And there'll be so many people, even in this election, as passionate as people are on the Trump side and on the Biden side, pandemic, recession/depression, you know, racial unrest, big election. There will be more people than you can imagine heading into election day, not sure if they're going to vote. There are going to be more people than you can imagine before registration deadline, not sure they're going to register. There's going to be more people than you imagine saying, I'm going to vote, but I don't like Biden or Trump. I'm going to vote third party. This election will be determined not by people who put bumper stickers on their car or wear T-shirts, who are apathetic by nature, who aren't sure any of it makes a difference. And the best way to get those people to vote is to talk to them and say why and listen to them. Good organizing starts with good listening. Well, what do you care about? And maybe you can find common cause with that person. So we live, you know, you and I live in San Francisco. We are surrounded by companies who spend every minute of every day trying to bring a little bit more efficiency to what they do, save people a second. So if you call 100 voters and only talk to three, that can seem wildly efficient. But let's say you actually convince one person to do something. That can seem silly and small. But if 5,000 other people are doing that day, you've gotten like a significant way towards the win numbers. So that's what I want to like put on the blinders. Know a lot of people aren't going to talk to you. Some people may be rude. It's just stuff we have to do.
Well, you make it pretty clear that on election day, you don't want, you as a voter do not want to feel any regrets. And reading your book, one thing I noticed is you often say, get going early. So early voting is one of the things that you recommend. And I'm, you know, we're talking a lot about states that are trying to bring voting by mail because of the pandemic. How do you think that's going to change the outcome, if at all? And why is Donald Trump so afraid of voting by mail? He does it.
Well, he does it. Although we actually heard today, he when he tried to register in Florida, he put in his Washington address. So the only instance of voter fraud that's now been verified in the state of Florida is Donald Trump. Okay, which is highly ironic. So he shouldn't be, because the truth is, you know, the research on this is pretty clear. No one party enjoys an advantage in vote by mail. Now, from the presidential campaign, I think it should give people great solace that the six battleground states, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, you know, maybe Georgia will come in there, maybe Iowa, maybe Ohio. All of those currently allow vote by mail without excuse. And all of them allow early voting in person, if that's going to be an option. So it's so important to get that vote in the bank. So if somebody's not a reliable voter, if something happens on election day, they're the people who aren't going to show up. Get that vote in the bank. If you yourself are a citizen and you're going to help on election day, want to help Joe Biden, you shouldn't be worrying about yourself voting on election day. Get that vote in the bank. So it's critically important. I like it as a political practitioner because you know who got sent a ballot and you know if they've returned it or not. And if Grace hasn't returned a ballot after 6 days, that's important information. You can go chase that. But both parties do that. So Trump is just, you know, he wants to suppress the vote. And I think he's sending a message to Vladimir Putin to, you know, do a lot of messaging around vote by mail, that it's illegal, that there's fraud, just to try and churn things up to give him an advantage.
Well, in going to Putin, we were talking about social media and how you can make a post, and you talk about a homegrown content army, which in your book. But how does one person's tweet or post stand out when there are these algorithm-generated massive amounts of content and actually disinformation that you find on social media? How does one person combat that?
Right. Well, one person doesn't, but millions of people can, number one. So that's it. They have Putin, and I'm sure they'll have others, because any global leader, particularly an adversary, like they're pinching themselves that they have an American president this weak and dumb and divisive. It's great for them. So they're going to do that. Fox, Breitbart, Sinclair, Prager University, Epoch Times, some of the biggest advertisers on social media are all command and control on the right. We don't have that on the left. But what we have is people. Okay. So first of all, if you share a piece of content or create a piece of content, that could be a quick video that you do, or you write something. If only the people in your own network see it, that's great, because they'll see what you posted. Maybe they'll repost it. It may be an argument they hadn't thought about, and gives other people courage to do it. But we see every day average citizens creating content or memes or GIFs, TikToks that go viral. You see this comedian, Sarah Cooper in New York, who's taken off with her, brilliant, performance, mimicking Trump speeches. So it doesn't have to reach millions of people. It can, but it will give comfort to people in your own network. Because I think there's a lot of people, like I know people who follow politics relatively carefully. They're not in the business like I used to be, but they're voters and they're progressives who said, I didn't know Joe Biden led the Recovery Act. Like, super important to know. Like, what's the one question on swing voters' mind in October? Who can dig us out of the economic hole? Here's Biden. It's not just that he's been in Washington forever. He led the Recovery Act, you know, which rebuilt the economy and created new industries. So we all have a lot of storytelling to do, I think. And the one thing I've learned in politics, particularly with the advent of social media, is never assume anybody has seen anything, knows anything. Like, overshare and be the person people are like, Grace, why are you sending this again? Just keep sending, keep sending. And, you know, better if it's something organic where it's like, you know, here's something I wrote about the protest and the difference between Biden or Trump. Or I have a neighbor who voted for Trump and I'm going to take a quick video and share that about why they're now voting for Biden. That's like gold.
Well, we're here on City Visions on KALW 91.7, getting a citizen's guide to how to beat Donald Trump. It's his new book. It's from David Plouffe. And you can call in and ask him a question. Our number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or find us at Twitter. We're at City Visions KALW. Well, you are a political practitioner and one of the best, so I can't resist asking you, what is Biden thinking about when it comes to his vice presidential candidate?
Yeah, I think this is the question on everybody's mind as it relates to the campaign. And I'd start by saying, you know, I led this process for Barack Obama that ended up in the selection of Joe Biden. So Joe Biden went through this process. So first of all, I'd say the campaign is secondary. The decision here Joe Biden will make will be first and foremost, if I win, who do I think would be my best partner? You know, the vice presidency used to get described as a warm bucket of spit. It had no responsibilities. That's changed. It's your most important counselor. It's somebody you give important projects to, both foreign policy and domestic. It's somebody who's got to work with Congress. So 90% of this will be, who do I want to serve with? Then you want to make sure, A, it's not someone who's going to hurt you in the campaign. That's the big mistake. And because of Biden's age, you know, voters, whether they're activists who are like giving Biden, you know, their time and money, or swing voters, like, this person could be president. Are they up to the job? So I think he's got to cross that threshold. But hopefully it's somebody who can help you a little bit. So I think it's great that he has now defined it. He's not worried about any men. He's just looking at women. We have a lot of great contenders out there. But a lot of this is also chemistry. It's not resume. It's like, who do I want to spend 8 years with? Who's not going to annoy me? Who will give me candid advice? Who's strong enough? Who's competent? And so when I went through this with Barack Obama, it was probably the thing in the campaign that he was least interested in his senior advisor's opinion on. He listened, but it's like, I have to live with this decision. So I'm making this decision.
What's your advice to Joe Biden?
Go with your gut. Like, so here's the thing, like, don't, like John Kerry said, he made a big mistake. He wanted to pick Dick Gephardt. I don't know if that would have allowed him to beat George Bush, but he went with Edwards because they're like, well, that's the new guy. And I didn't have a great vibe with him. Like, you have to go with your gut. So if candidate A may be less exciting or maybe somebody that will be criticized more, but it's like, this is the person I want. You have to live with this decision. The worst thing you want to do is pick somebody who's either a bad running mate or, more importantly, dead weight in the White House, or someone you can't trust, or someone who's not a good advisor, someone who screws up big projects. You can't have that. So this is a very lonely decision, actually, for that reason.
Well, we have a caller, Roy from El Cerrito. Hi, Roy. Are you there? Hold on one second. It's COVID radio, so we're trying to patch that in. Hi, Roy. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Do you have a question or a comment?
Yes. What do you see as the role of texting in the campaign? I've been texting for resistance labs, and I love doing it, and I'm able to speak with thousands of potential voters.
Roy, it's a great question, and it's increasingly becoming a really powerful tool, both in political campaigns, but also in local organizing efforts and issue advocacy efforts. So I think that's there's a lot of groups. The Biden campaign will obviously provide that capability. State Democratic parties, Indivisible, Swing Left, you know, groups like Planned Parenthood will be doing that, labor unions. So it's really great. Because again, you know, some of that may be a swing voter, but a lot of it will be, hey, just a reminder, voter registration deadlines tomorrow. Or just a reminder, absentee ballots are being sent out. Or, hey, you haven't sent in your absentee ballot. So, you know, there's a lot of people who don't want to talk by phone. but they might be willing to text with somebody and you can share information with them. So I think it's a really, really great tool. I'm glad you asked that. And that's a big change because even back in, let's say, 2012, the last campaign I was responsible for, it was not a big weapon. It was more important in 16, but it was a big a tool that so many of those great House candidates used in 2018 when we won back the House. So I think it's really important. And most of the primary campaigns, Bernie's campaign, you know, Pete Buttigieg's campaign, Kamala's campaign, used it really well. And, you know, the Biden campaign has hired some of those folks into their campaign, which I was really happy to see.
And how do you feel about the leadership of the Biden campaign? Do you feel confident in them?
I do. So the campaign manager now is General Mallie Dillon, who's just a superstar. She was our deputy campaign manager for Barack Obama in 2012, knows states inside or out. When I talk to Jen, which I still do with some frequency, she knows Florida, she knows Arizona, she knows North Carolina, because that's what a campaign is. It's how many votes do you need? That's everything you're doing. Like, and that sounds obvious, but sometimes it's like the tweet or the ad. It's like you're trying to get, you know, my guess is in Wisconsin, they're trying to get 1,650,000 votes. And in Florida, they probably have to try and get 5 million votes. Why is that, by the way? That's a lot more than 16, because Trump's going to have huge turnout. His people are coming, and they're going to come in big numbers. So she orients the entire campaign around that question. She's hired a lot of good people. But this is tough. You know, Trump's an incumbent. He's been planning on this for years. He's got all the money in the world, all the people in the world. Biden came out of the primary broke, understaffed, and has to make that turn right away to a completely different campaign. So I think she's done a good job. But my part of my message in the book is we can't expect Joe Biden. He's our nominee. I didn't know he would be when I wrote the book. We can't expect Joe Biden to be perfect, his campaign to be perfect, outside Democratic groups to be perfect. Like, we just got to get in the fight here and don't wait for the non-existent cavalry. The way Joe Biden's – so his speech yesterday – a lot more people saw the speech because a lot of people, I know I did, I'm sure people on listening did, shared it because not everybody's like knew it was happening, didn't see it. So, oh, I'll take a look at that. So our responsibility is to be that army out there for Joe Biden and other Democratic candidates. We have a huge disadvantage because they have command and control. Trump tweets, Fox, Breitbart, talk radio, local Sinclair TV stations, these amazingly powerful platforms on Facebook, like Epoch Times, like Prager University, that probably, Grace, some of your listeners don't know about, but they are a massive presence. The right has a huge advantage on YouTube, massive advantage that we have to really cut into over time. So we have to be the citizens in that fight. But the Biden campaign, I think, is really strengthening. I think they've done really good ads. I'm excited that he's starting to get out a little bit more. Because that's the thing, like, you can't four corners your way to the presidency. So yes, Trump is hurting himself right now. But my view of politics is, rather than just sit back and let your opponent do damage, how do you make them do more damage? You know, how do you get them to respond to you? How do you put them on the defensive? And Trump right now is in a very perilous political moment. So Biden has to maximize this. It may be that Trump stays in this terrible place the rest of the election. That would be awesome. But you can't count on that. He may have a comeback to some degree. But there's a lot of voters right now you can lock in, a lot of volunteers you can recruit, a lot of donors you can recruit. So you got to maximize these moments. They don't come around very often in politics.
Well, one thing in your book, you say nothing beats eye-to-eye contact, you know, one-on-one conversation with a potential voter. With a pandemic, obviously a lot harder. What are some of the strategies that you are seeing people using? Are we just going to be Zooming prospective voters from Wisconsin and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, some of those folks may be into a VC, but that's kind of an intimate thing. Like, or they want to get a video with somebody. Maybe you could find a group of voters. So maybe there's like, hey, here's 25 undecided voters, you know, in Lackawanna County, Pennsylvania, that have an issue they want to talk about. And the Biden campaign finds somebody to do that. I'd love to see them do that. Because that's your campaign needs to know that. They need to know the 25 people in Lackawanna County, pretty big county, who are undecided. But I think phone calls, texting, social media, my guess is you're going to see in the fall, you know, it might not be universal. There may be some states like Florida where you're doing more door knocking. And there may be some states where you're not. You know, health officials will determine that, government officials, people's comfort in doing it. You know, maybe you're doing it with a mask. You know, maybe you're not right up in the screen. So if door knocking is something that is a green light, then we're all going to have to, you know, not everyone will be comfortable doing it. But that still is like nothing substitute that. A human being looking to someone, reading their cues, listening to them. You know, you don't get the same, you get some of that on a video, but you get much less of that obviously on a phone call or a text. So I hope mainly because it means we don't have the second wave that we're all able to do door knocking in the fall. But if we're not, then we're going to have to use these other. And so the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign are having to refashion their, and they have to plan for different scenarios. One is lockdown. Second is no lockdown. Third is lockdown some places, not lockdown others. And, you know, that's super complicated, but that's just what they're going to have to figure out.
Well, one thing I like about your book is that you don't give anybody, you don't let people off the hook. You're basically like, if you don't like to do the door knocking, you can write a postcard. If you don't want to write a postcard, you can write a letter to the editor. And I think people forget that social media isn't just on their phones, but it's newspapers and showing up in different places. But the shortest chapter in your book is about money. And you have said that you got to prioritize volunteer work over bank account. Explain that, because it feels like the Republicans have a lot of money.
Well, they do. And I think so. Joe Biden doesn't need the amount of money Donald Trump has. He needs the amount of money Joe Biden needs to win the race. So I write this in a book, and this is, I'm doing a lot of fundraising for Joe Biden. So if you've got the ability to give, you should do that. There's no question about that. Less people have that ability now with the pandemic, but if you have the ability, you should give. My point in the book is, one, it's the thing most people do. It's easy to do. You can just, you know, in 5 seconds on your phone, give a contribution. It's important, but we need more than that. That's my main message. My second message is, don't make a financial sacrifice to fund the campaign. There's plenty of people who don't need to do that who can fund the campaign. So, you know, maybe you can't give $25, but you can do texting or phone calls or, you know, share on social media. You should do that. So money is the thing most people do. It's incredibly important. Biden does come into this with a deficit. So and all of us who have the ability to help Joe Biden need to help Joe Biden with money. But it's then what? That's not enough. It's simply not enough. You got to get in the game. So if you've got family members in battleground states, I have a sister who moved from Ohio to Florida, right? What are you doing? Are you a precinct captain? Why don't, you know, you got to get in the game. You know, if you've got friends who moved into a battleground state, are you registered? Are you volunteering? Be a precinct leader. Convince them to do it. When I was on my book tour, which got cut short by the pandemic, I went to the battleground states. And the last one I did was Ohio. But I remember being in Wisconsin, my second to last book tour, you know, the message I, because somebody was asking, like, you know, it's like all the pressure's on us here. I said, yeah, it is. You know, so we're going to help you, but like the entire world's counting on you. And I wish you didn't have that pressure, but you do. So if you live in a battleground state, you have an extra responsibility to step up and deliver. But all of us who don't live in battleground states then have to have our own checklists. What else can I do? And so keep in mind, yes, Joe Biden's important, but I always think about, you know, the single mom, you know, in Milwaukee, who's doesn't have much time, but she's decided to give 20 hours a week to help Joe Biden. Everything you're doing is to help that person be as effective as possible to get enough votes in her precinct so we can win Wisconsin and win the presidency back.
Well, do you think that this is a good opportunity 2020 to win back the Senate for Democrats?
Well, I do. And, you know, because Democrats are less competitive in as many states as we used to be, it wasn't too long ago. As you remember, we had senators, we had all four senators in the Dakotas. You know, we had more senators in southern states, plain states. Right now, that's not realistic. So I would guess the most senators the Democratic Party could have right now in any year is like 54, which means we don't have a Senate race to waste. So anytime you have a competitive race, you have to win it. So both to win back the Senate this year, but to also protect against any downturn in future Senate cycles. So we have to win Colorado. We have to win Arizona. We have to win Maine. We have to win North Carolina. We have to fight like hell. You know, Doug Jones, I think, is an underdog right now, but maybe he can pull it out. So we got to win all that. You know, there's even some states like Iowa, you know, that could get interesting. Georgia. So, yes. Listen, if Joe Biden wins the presidency, I'd say our odds of winning the Senate are better than 50-50. If he wins the presidency by 3 or 4 points, you know, I think we're almost assuredly going to win the Senate. And, you know, maybe with enough margin that we could sit at 51 or 52. And then my hope is our Senate leaders decide to get rid of the filibuster. We have to do that. And the flip side of this, Grace, is if we don't win this election, if Donald Trump wins, the thing I want people to think about is this doesn't have to happen, but, you know, there could be two additional Supreme Court nominations. There's going to be judicial appointments all over the country. So 8 years of federal judges. What if we have a Supreme Court that's 7-2 with two more Kavanaughs? What that would mean is the Democratic Party could win every election from 2021 to 2041. And there's a little in the progress we can make. They'll just, the courts, not just at the Supreme Court level, but all throughout the land, will be rejecting things and playing politics. So we have to win this. So the optimistic thing is Biden wins, we get rid of Trump, we get the Senate back, we hold the House, we help win local races. That's really important for redistricting. That's like the light side. The dark side is Trump wins, we don't win the Senate back, and the federal judiciary is lost for a generation.
Well, if that isn't motivation from former Obama campaign manager David Plouffe to get involved, I don't know what is. We've been fortunate to hear from David Plouffe. He's the former campaign manager for Barack Obama, and his new book is called A Citizen's Guide to Beating Donald Trump. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. We appreciate hearing from you.
Grace, good to see you, and thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Yep. Next up, we'll be hearing from award-winning jazz guitarist Terrence Brewer. Terrence Brewer is with us tonight. He's an award-winning jazz guitarist and educator. He's performed at the Monterey Jazz Festival and SF Jazz, among other venues. And his latest album is Don't Worry About Me, featuring Pamela Rose. During the pandemic, he's been teaching and working on his music, and we're delighted to have him join us. Welcome, Terrence.
Hi, Grace. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Music and live performances are something many of us enjoyed before the pandemic. And as an artist, I wondered, how is your community surviving right now?
Yeah, it's mixed. I'll start by saying that. First and foremost, there's nothing like being in a space with live music happening. The energy, the vibrations you get, the camaraderie and community you get being in a creative space with other people, making music, listening to music, enjoying music. So there's nothing like that. So without that, there is no replacement. I will say on the other side of that, though, thank goodness for technology. And for those of us that live as musicians and creative people in a very analog world where we get up and we play instruments that you have to physically move with your hands and put wind through to make sound and beat on and drum on, you know, the digital world has saved a lot of what we get to do as artists. And I will say that, you know, having participated in a fair amount of you know, fundraising concerts, tribute videos, things of that nature over the last, you know, 10 weeks, it is actually pretty amazing the community that can be built in the digital space. There is something that happens. There is that sort of endorphin rush and release that you get from seeing all the little boxes of people's faces and people typing in the chat box if you're doing a Zoom performance. So there is a little bit of a feeling of community and feeling of being creative that we are getting. Financially, it's been difficult. Financially, it's been an interesting journey. And what I mean by that is, you know, many of us lost a lot of the work that we do, teaching in schools, performing, obviously in clubs, people, you know, losing their tours that they had planned for 6 months, 9 months, a year out. And at the same time, what I'm finding is that there's a lot more people who are, for example, teaching more online now because they have the time. Other people have the time to want to study. There are people who are certainly very actively taking their own approach when it comes to putting on their own concerts, when it comes to being collectively unified with other artists to put on concerts and events. So the beautiful thing about art, right, is it always finds a way. Right. It is the flower that grows up through the concrete, the cracks in the concrete. And music, art always finds the place where it can make itself known, heard, and seen. And we're seeing so much of that. And what a lot of us are having to do is to pivot very quickly, learn technology in a way that maybe we weren't used to working with before. But the thing about most artists and most musicians is their creative hustle and their creative drive, the thing that led them to practice for hours a day, years upon years, and drive to gigs and play shows at midnight and 1 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, in your teens and 20s, play shows for $25 or for free or whatever, for gas money. All the things that led those people to have that creative drive were also the things that led them, have led us to find whatever creative outlet we can particularly find and to find a place in this space that works for us.
Well, we're also living through not just a pandemic, but the protests and demonstrations that we talked about earlier in the hour. And in preparing for tonight's show, I came across a quote, I think it's from Amanda Seales, and she said about music, you cannot have the rhythm and ignore the blues. And I wondered, as a jazz artist, we only have a few minutes, does that speak to you, that idea, you can't have the rhythm without the blues?
Absolutely. I mean, for those that, you know, if you were able to see the shirt I'm wearing, Miles and Bessie and Louie and Josephine and Dizzy and Monk and Nina, right? I mean, you say we only have a few minutes, but the reality is that most music that we have cultivated here on this soil has come out of the Black experience, has come out of the African diaspora, has come out of the African American experience in this country. And, you know, it's interesting because that quote has a really great sort of quote that follows it, which is they want our rhythm, but they don't want our blues, which is a lot of what we're seeing right now that's happening across the country and across the world. Yeah, the reality is that a lot of art is created from a place of needing to be seen, needing to be felt, wanting to be heard, wanting to be respected, wanting to be able to understand that you have a place and that you have a voice. And that continues. And when the clubs shut down as a result of the pandemic, when, you know, festivals were canceled and summer camps were canceled, artists have been continually finding these ways to be seen and felt and heard and respected. And for a lot of us, it has pushed us to be even more creative in some ways, because the connection that we're trying to get via this digital medium is so much more difficult than it is in person. So it takes that much more effort to be dialed into what people want to hear. And you hear a lot of so many more people really speaking from the heart, because we never expected this, right? We never imagined that this is a thing that could or would happen. So when it hit and people really started to realize the impact that it was going to have financially, spiritually, emotionally on us as creative people, it took a toll. And what I found was that my friends and fellow artists were very quick to go deep into their sort of personal arsenal of creativity to express how they felt. And it's resulted in some beautiful, beautiful work.
Well, we're excited to hear more of your work and definitely want to hear both your rhythm and your blues. Terrence Brewer, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
My pleasure.
Award-winning jazz guitarist Terrence Brewer. He's a musician and an educator. And we'll be listening to one of his pieces as we go out tonight. But that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were former Obama campaign manager and Democratic political strategist David Plouffe. We also heard from San Francisco Chronicle columnist Otis Taylor and Terrence Brewer. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Jillian Emblad and Susie Britton. Join us next week as we continue to address the current protests around police brutality and the death of George Floyd, as well as provide a coronavirus update. Good night, and thanks for listening. Be well.
Charlie Parker's Yardbird Suite featuring Terrence Brewer.